Perhaps I should announce at this time, where everyone is settled quietly, that there will be refreshments after the lecture this morning. We have a new art exhibit in the library, and of course we're going to have an important production this afternoon. The film will be shown as indicated on the program at approximately 2 o'clock, but the gentleman who is presenting it to us will give a discussion of the film and interesting matter relating to it beginning about 1:30. So we hope that you will all be able to be here. This morning we have a very intriguing subject that has come into strong focus in recent years. Up to 10 or 15 years ago, there was very little communication, ethically or psychologically, between the kingdoms of nature. But in the last few years, the film industry and television have brought into very sharp focus the problems of ecology and have given us a deeper and more sympathetic understanding of the problems of animal life. Many of these films are tremendously significant and should be of great meaning to really thoughtful persons. They all sum up to one basic concept, namely that one life vitalizes everything that exists in nature, and that this one life is shared by all the kingdoms of nature, and that man does not have a unique control of universal life force. It is distributed through the great and the small, through the complicated and the simple, and its tremendous pressure of this force continues age after age, bestowing life and finding innumerable ways of perpetuating itself. In the Western world, the animal has never had, generally speaking at least, the attention it deserves. From the very earliest records of Egypt and Chaldea, Babylonia, Greece, and Rome, we hear the stories of the great hunters that went out to hunt animals, that these hunters considered hunting a sport. While some of the lesser people realized that it was essential to their survival, in a great many instances, at even a very ancient times, in the West especially, hunting was a privilege. No one considered the animal, and the hunter was rewarded for an achievement which actually was no achievement at all in most cases. The animal had no solution, no answer, no defense against the inroads of human cunning and skill. So we have to look a little around to see what we can find out that would help us to understand the importance of this particular subject, especially at this season of the year. Then let us consider where the animal has been best understood. And I think we must admit that that has been among Asiatic peoples. This does not mean that the Asiatic does not also forget the philosophies and religions he has received. But generally speaking, the understanding of animal life has been more explored in Hinduism and in Buddhism than in any of the Western philosophies and religions. These Eastern faiths have included animals in the concept of the universal plan of things. Occasionally, a Western mystic has done the same. And we remember how St. Francis of Assisi preached to the birds. And we know that at certain rituals of the year in the church, animals are given special attention, and animals are brought together for baptism. This is part of an old tradition, but it's not very widespread in the West. To the Westerner, the animal is still something that really doesn't count. A few domesticated animals with which we have had long and intimate association have very good friends among humans. People have given great attention to animals, but it has been as a result of a personal affection. a companionship, a sympathy that has been brought into existence by the needs of the human and by consideration for the rights of life in general. In the East, however, in the Oriental countries, it was carried to a still greater extreme, especially, I think, among the Buddhist peoples. As their philosophy is essentially derived from Hinduism, the philosophy of animals, as is taught in the Oriental systems, perhaps is as good a key to our present relationship as we can find anywhere in contemporary life. Back in the 7th century, one of the Japanese emperors issued an edict against killing animals for any reason. And in order to support this edict, he also had to consider those who made a living from hunting for food. He subsidized them. This particular program was expanded in the reign of the next emperor and then in the following empress. And during this time, fishermen were paid not to fish. Persons involved in all forms of animal activity upon which they depended for a living were compensated by the state so as not to find it necessary to kill animals. At the time the first American consul general was sent to Japan, the first thing he asked for when he got there was a beefsteak. This practically caused an international crisis because no Japanese at that time had any idea of that type of eating. Of course, as soon as it was noised about what the consul general wanted, it followed that every farmer hid his cattle. No one wanted to be the one to sacrifice his dear friends, his four-footed brethren, for this particular purpose. Finally, however, the government was able to buy a cow which was killed and served to the consul. As a reminder of this, after the incident, a monument in the memory of the cow was raised in Japan, and it was listed among the martyrs. Now, we don't expect anyone to go quite that far, but it is still true that the effort was made definitely to prevent any, we might say, sport hunting of animals or any torture or abuse of them. The farmer and his oxen were brothers. They worked the rice paddies together. And when the old ox passed on, finally, of old age, a little monument was built to its memory at the corner of the farm, and from that time, regularly, a little offering of food or incense was placed upon the altar. This was a relationship that we know nothing about, practically, among Western people. We do have people who will do anything in the they can possibly do to take care of animals well. But in the large pattern of things, we haven't been able to achieve this degree of humanity. Today, Western civilization, especially America, is probably the greatest meat-consuming country in the world. This means that actually the American people eat more meat than probably any other nation can afford. And as a result of this, the physical cost of meat is rising rapidly. For some time, there's been a suspicion floating around that this was not entirely a good idea, even entirely apart from the effect upon animal life, that it was not a good idea for the human being to eat a large amount of meat, that this led almost inevitably to physical ailments, had a tendency to shorten life, and that it was a mistake to assume that meat was the source of strength. It might give some assistance or physical stamina to those in very heavy physical labor. But for the most part, excessive meat eating is detrimental to health and has a certain effect upon psychology. The individual is less sensitive, less considerate, less integrated as a person, less kindly and sympathetic and understanding as the result of a heavy meat diet. It is therefore perhaps something we should all remember, namely that it is not necessary for the human person, the human being, who is by nature a predator and a carnivore, to indulge these habits as much as he does. After all, behind all of these things, there has to be a philosophy of some kind. And the problem of the meaning of it all has interested a great many. Probably the outstanding vegetarian in Western philosophy was Pythagoras of Samos. And from him have descended a number of groups that have refrained from animal food. The Neoplatonists of Alexandria wrote extensively on abstinence from animal food as being a very important factor in the unfoldment of the inner superior factors and facets of human consciousness. In the Orient, it was assumed, and I think this is perhaps the basis of a great many thoughts, it was assumed that all living things form one family. The Oriental nearly always refers to an animal as his little brother and assumes that as some mysterious invisible power in space protects human beings, so in a sense at least, man is the god of the kingdoms below his own. Man is therefore the god of the animal and of the vegetables and all plant life, and also of the mineral world. Now, the Oriental is concerned with the simple fact that all of these kingdoms are alive. The idea that some of them only appear to be alive, and if they are alive, it doesn't count, was entirely contrary to the convictions of most Oriental peoples. It was also contrary to the conviction of probably one of Western man's greatest horticulturists, Luther Burbank, who was perfectly aware, as he said, that while man has 5 senses, that plants have as many as 20 sensory perceptions. But they are different from ours. They live in a different world. And to them, our world is a strange, often wicked place where ghosts and demons threaten their lives. As we believed in the Middle Ages, that ghosts and demons threatened our survival. In many instances, we are ghosts and demons to the members of the lesser kingdoms. I remember Ernest Thompson Seton told me a very interesting story. He said that the mysterious influence of man in the life of the animal is far greater than we realize. Animals, under normal conditions, if attacked or hazarded, will run to the human being for protection. He tells a story of a hunter who was hunting deer and finally found this deer and was on the verge of shooting it when the animal ran and took shelter beside another hunter who was also armed with a gun. But the animal believed in some mysterious way that this second hunter would not hurt him. And the hunter was so affected by this episode that he persuaded the other man not to kill the deer, and it went with him for a long way through the forest. The animal certainly has a strange respect for the human being. And in Buddhism, we have a number of interesting parallels of this. We are told that Buddha not only incarnated as a human being, but incarnated in some form in each one of the kingdoms of nature and became the protector and guardian of that kingdom, and that each kingdom has the equivalent of a great spiritual teacher assigned to it, and that this assigned creature takes the form and body of that animal or plant, lives with it, but has mysterious psychic ways of communicating with it and assisting it in the unfoldment of its nature. So that most of these people are very particular on this particular subject. I know that even now, in the monasteries and temples of Japan, birds and animals are constantly present. Some have felt that these presences have been a little detrimental to the temples. But the old bonzes or priests who guard the temples say they would rather by far be a sanctuary for life than worry about the effect of it on the architecture. So they feed them, take care of them, and guard them as members of a family. And when they die, they are buried with a Buddhist ritual. Now, this would all seem very fantastic to Western man. He doesn't think of these things at all, but then what explanation does he really have for the animal world? The films that we are seeing constantly now reveal the tremendous complication that exists in all the kingdoms of nature. It is inconceivable the wisdom, the skill, the mysterious life power that is able to produce the many lenses of the eye of one housefly. Everything that lives is a mechanical masterpiece and sold by a vital principle. Even the most humble thing is alive, and the life that is in that thing has mysteriously manifested every type of form and condition that we can imagine. Thousands of plant forms, some of them so wonderful and beautiful that they are breathtaking. Thousands of minerals of all kinds and types hidden within the earth. Yet every one of these minerals is a chemical masterpiece. It has coloration, it has vibration, it has existence. It is alive. There is nothing dead in the world except a stupid human being. Everything else is alive. And because it is alive, it has responsibilities and it has privileges. And the search for the privileges that living things have is becoming more and more engrossing to modern man. We also beginning to realize that the gradual destruction of the proper grazing environments, the disfiguring of our environment, and the various pollutions that are coming along are not only endangering human life, but are endangering defenseless life, life that has no way of protecting itself against the aggravations of mankind. And out of this, perhaps we are looking for an answer. What has science to tell us about how life creates the feathered structure of a bird's wing? Or how does it give us the full understanding of the tremendous involvement and complexity of a small garden worm? These things science cannot explain. They do not know how and why these creatures exist. The only thing we can do is catalog them, analyze them as to their structures and functions, and try to list the peculiarities and in some cases what we regard as valuable byproducts of these forms of life. We do not know anything about the life in them any more than we really know very much about the life in ourselves. The Oriental thinker simply brings it back to the Pythagorean hypothesis, namely, that there is only one life. This totality of existence we call life. It involves not only the kingdoms of nature that we see and appreciate, but countless forms of invisible life. This one life involves the planets and the stars. It involves everything that exists in the universe. There is a life there. For if it was not there, it could not be diffused or distributed throughout the structures of living creatures. Where this life comes from, we are not too certain. Some have assumed that the source of it was the sun. Others assume that the source of it is nutrition. Some believe that it comes from some strange remote process of space that we do not as yet even comprehend. But that this life is undeniable. And that this life is a strange motive power. That this life ensouls forms, or even creates forms, multiplies them. This same life destroys them in the course of time, or transforms them into other forms of life. But always one tremendous life energy ensouls the universe. The Oriental thinker, working with this particular problem, could only finally come to the conclusion that this eternal life everywhere, this omnipresent, omniscient, omniactive life, was definitely an attribute of God. Therefore, the life in anything is the God in that thing. And that life and that God in that thing is the most powerful potential mystery of all time, because it reveals the divine power in the process of eternal creation, eternal renovation, a constant maintenance of these various forms of life on all the levels of this universal system. We have this, therefore, as a thought, namely, that there is a life, that this life, perhaps, we could as well as not term God. If it is not God, it is certainly a primary manifestation of deity. Now, as we study this life more and more, we realize that it contains within itself a very wide diversity of energies, powers, and specializations. And we must finally agree with the Chaldeans that this life energy is intelligent, that this force is not a blind force. It is not something that merely fuels things, like the gasoline in a combustion engine. For this life is the only fuel in the universe which repairs and restores its own mechanisms. And not only that, but extends them, complicates them, perpetuates them. It is not only a fuel process, it is a survival process, and within it, an infinite manifestation of intelligent specialization. Every form in nature is geometrically perfect in its own right and power. It is composed of innumerable lesser parts, cells, atoms, everything, brought together in a magnificent compound. And the power that ensouls this compound and creates it has to be the only one thing that exists, universal life. This universal life, therefore, seems to be locked into a sun ray. And when the light of the sun strikes us, it is not simply a way of giving us a quick tan or by giving us a certain amount of vital resistance. It is a process by means of which the infinite complexity of the human body itself is variously vitalized. And this life that comes from the sun is distributed through an infinite series of manifestations. We can see it in a meadow, where one light ray descending from the sun maintains 100 forms of plants, flowers, trees, and shrubs, each one receiving that which is necessary to itself, each taking that one life and molding it and modeling it to the needs of its own existence. This situation is so remarkable that it would seem that it would make a theologian out of every scientist, because there is simply no way of explaining this without assuming a universal intelligence at the source of life. And that this universal intelligence is omniscient, that it is capable of extending itself into every conceivable specialization that has existed, does exist, or ever can come into existence. The Orientalist, working on this basis, has come to the simple conclusion that there is a direct responsibility between forms of life, in which in each instance a superior form is responsible for that which is less evolved than itself. Each superior is in a parental relationship to that which is less mature than its own structure. Therefore, every form of life, according to Eastern thinking, is responsible in some degree and in some way for the protection of other forms of life that are less advanced or less specialized. Of course, the Oriental points to the mind. The human mind is a specialization. It can only exist because it is an aspect of a divine mind. That which is not mind cannot produce mind. There has to be the seed of mind in the infinite, or it cannot be made manifest in man. But this mind gives man a proprietorship. It gives him an understanding of life. It gives him a way of measuring and estimating the natures of lesser things. It reveals to him something of the majesty of space, and it also gives him an understanding of the millions of forms of life in a few drops of water. This mind, then, as a contemplator, as a considerer of all things, has within itself the power to serve and protect forms of life that otherwise are not able to protect themselves. So the human being, while he does not need to be fanatical on the subject, has also to bear in mind that as a gardener in the garden of the Lord, for he was placed in a garden to take care of it, and therefore he is responsible for all of the types of life that are in that garden. He's the good physician. He is the kindly friend. He is the one who protects the garden against weeds, and it also, in one way or another, ultimately protects the weeds from themselves. All down through this mystery of life, then, we have this one tremendous vitality, a vitality that informs things, and when we destroy a living thing, we take away from it the body and the vitality. We leave the vitality homeless when we destroy the form in which it is naturally supposed to exist. Now, because the life of things is infinite, there is no possibility of man destroying life itself. What he calls a destruction is to remove it from manifestation in a given form or in a given structure. Death is merely the transference of life from an objective to a subjective existence. It has nothing to do with the continuity of life itself. This is something that the Oriental has also given great thought to and has tried to help to use this as a means of understanding the mysteries of the animal kingdom. Now, through the films and through the various media that have been developing recently, we have developed the concept or become aware of the concept of the food chain, in which everything seems to live from everything else. Every form of life survives upon some other form of life. And from the lowest to the highest condition, forms of life are nutritioned by the lives of other forms. This has caused considerable sorrow and worry to those who love animal life, because it seems as though there is no way of preventing life from surviving upon life. This may not be quite as serious as we think, for the simple reason that we are now dealing not with a life that is passing from one thing to another. We are dealing with a life that is everywhere, always. That the only thing that is obliterated or removed is the vehicle of that life. But the vehicle itself is not the life, nor is the life destroyed by it. The Indians and East Indian philosophers have always assumed that animal creatures have an immortality the same as all other creatures. Even plants and minerals have a kind of immortality. It's different from anything we understand, but it still exists. Therefore, what we are really saying is that we are surviving on various levels from the bodies and vital instruments of other creatures. But the vitality itself, the source of it, the principle of it, is indestructible. And the lives of the various creatures are carefully measured, weighed, and estimated by natural law. Let's say for a moment, then, that we want to understand this a little clearer. We have at the moment under consideration four types of life that exist in this material environment that we see: the mineral, the plant, the animal, and the human. Now, scientists are trying desperately to make the man merely an animal, and that the fourth kingdom consists of all vertebrates, such as man, and that, therefore, man is simply an animal that has grown up a little more and become a little more dangerous, by the way. This, however, does not meet the requirement of most classical thinking. The Darwinian theory is very objectionable to most serious thinkers, because it fails to take into consideration that we are dealing with four separate kingdoms of life, four waves of life. And the Brahmins, with their cosmotheology, have carefully described, differentiated, and studied these four waves of life. In other words, the minerals are a kingdom in themselves. They are a unity within a greater unity. All minerals have certain vibratory keynotes in common, and they are all under the control of what might be called a mineral entity. In other words, there is a parental mineral principle that guards, unfolds, and protects all mineral structures in nature. And very often these structures are served further by a series of invisible beings who are regarded as nature spirits in antiquity. But the mineral has a complete structure in itself. There is one mineral manifesting through an infinite diversity of mineral types and subtypes and divisions and subdivisions. But all mineral is one complete entity in itself. And the deity or god of the mineral is the protecting power of the total mineral archetype. We can call these guardians archetypes in the Western thinking. They are the overshadowing totalities of their kind. Underneath or within the structure of such an archetype, we will find subtypes, each with their own rulerships, until actually the government of a kingdom of nature is almost a complete cosmic theology in itself. All different forms of life are under certain general rules and orders. The second form of the kingdoms, the plant kingdom, also has its own archetype. It has the development of all forms of plant life. They are all specializations within one total plant energy. And this energy, in turn, is a specialization within the total life power of the universe. The various types of plants are like races within or upon the continent of plant integration. There are all kinds of subdivisions, as there are subdivisions of races among human beings. There are different kinds of plants, each with a different purpose. And some of these plants, as the scriptures tell us, are for the healing of the nations. Each plant has its rules and its laws and belongs to its own kingdom. And the subdivisions of that kingdom are all under an archetypal plant energy, a conscious mental plant integration. The third one of these is the animal kingdom. And in referring to these overshadowing principles, they're often called the group spirits. These group spirits represent the total guardianship of the animal kingdom. They are the archetypes within which all animals are differentiated, and in which each type of animal has its own subdivision and its own organization and life purpose. Now, these inner divisions within the substance of a kingdom are no two of them alike, nor are any two of them on exactly the same level of manifestation or integration. Therefore, within the animal kingdom, there is a ladder, so to say, an ascending order of animals. In the plant kingdoms, there are ascending orders of plants. And in the mineral kingdoms, there are ascending orders of the vibratory rates of mineral structures. So that the animal constitutes, therefore, a complete world of itself. It has within it all types of animal life, from those which are the most primitive to those which are the most highly organized. Now, the animal world, being a world which has sensational existence, can move and can propagate by various means. The animal has a larger field of activity. This field of activity affects the animal structure in a number of ways. It affects especially through the horizontal spine. The energies of the earth pass horizontally through the animal kingdom. In the plant kingdom, they pass vertically from below up And in the mineral kingdom, they are diffused. In the human kingdom, they descend vertically from the top down. Therefore, all living things are divided by these orders of energy implementation. Now, animals, from the lowest to the highest, present many phases of interest to the individual. They are gradually unfolding what might be termed the emotional content. The animal lives on what we would term an animal level, and we very often think of that as an emotional level. The animal's emotional life is variously influenced by circumstances around it, but we see gradually unfolding through the animal most of the potentials, most of the basic divisions which are later to appear in the human being. We find the animal with territories which it defends. We find animals gradually becoming more and more protective of their young. We find animals that have tremendous intelligence and in many ways appear to be practically human in their intelligence. Among the animal kingdom, of course, among the highest of them among the animals would certainly be the elephant, which incidentally is one of the largest mammals, the largest land mammal that there is, and is a complete vegetarian. The elephant has tremendous skill in memory, and there have been many very authentic accounts of the peculiar ability of elephants to estimate human behavior. They are also said to be the only animals with a sense of humor. And among other things, they must have it because they are the only animals that can laugh at human beings. I remember a case in India, near the city of Jaipur. I went on an elephant ride up to an old palace that had been long deserted. Among those riding on the howdah was a lady with a very elaborate flower-strewn hat. I noticed the elephant had his eye on that hat even before the ride started. But it was very docile and had a twist at the corner of the mouth around the tusk that looked very much like a leer of some kind. As we went up the hill towards the old palace, suddenly or slowly, the trunk of the elephant came up behind its ear, and it worked its way up until it could reach that hat. Without seeing the hat, it was able to pluck it right off of the lady's head. And then the trunk stretched out in front and raised high, swinging the hat. And with grunts and roars, the animal went the rest of the trip, waving the hat. No one can say that that animal didn't have a sense of humor. Animals like the elephant also are remarkably intelligent. They are believed, and from rather careful exploration, that they actually have a religion, that they do perform some type of religious rites. It is also certain that they have leaders among their own kind who are very, very wise, and that the wisdom of the elephant is not merely a superstition, but is very much a fact. If you watched elephants in Burma piling teak, you would realize that you have very thoughtful animals. They are not only able to pile these teak trunks in good form, but having made a little pile, they will go back several feet, look it over carefully, and then come back and square up a few logs that were out of position. They do all of these things, and they are also, in many respects, a very gentle and docile animal unless they're abused. Anyway, here is an animal that is a very highly intelligent one. There are others also. And among the fish, the dolphin has been proverbial, known to the Greeks and also one of the earliest symbols of Christianity. We find many of these creatures having powers that we do not understand or know. The reason why they have these powers is because every creature has them latently. But to certain types of animals, birds, fishes, necessity forces the specialization of growth. In order to survive in their own environment or to fulfill their own purposes, they have to have a chance to develop or have to intuitively release from within themselves the powers necessary to their own survival. Birds that have to migrate 5 or 10,000 miles are given the equipment to do it. bats have an inbuilt sonar system. I remember in one of the caves down in New Mexico, they stretched wires across the mouth of the caves from which the bats came at night. The idea being that in the dark, the bats would run against these wires. When the time came and the bats came out by the 100,000, not one of them touched a wire. They had their built-in protection. And though they couldn't see the wire, they instinctively avoided it. All these different specializations have been variously mistaken as being something that was leading up to humanity, that the animal was on its way up to being a human being. In a sense, this is correct, but not in the Darwinian sense, not in the sense that we have generally thought about it. The next kingdom, of course, we consider is the human, which has existed for a very long time. The earliest known examples of humanity were still human. And before that, we have very little record to go on to find out what man's original development was. But we may suspect that, as in the case of many religious philosophies, that these kingdoms were not completely products of evolution, but were created. They were fashioned or created to form an avenue for the release of a great current of divine energy. And they were brought into manifestation in order that that energy might gradually diffuse itself through every atom of space. The human being, therefore, has been endowed with certain factors and faculties which, in many instances, rather closely resemble animal propensities. They may seem to look very much like it. And there are types of very aboriginal human beings from which it is difficult sometimes to be sure that they did not develop from one of the higher anthropoidal animals. But they did not. The human being is a great wave in itself. It is one of the four great orders of life that we have here on this planet.